Denise, I really feel like we don't just have a climate crisis. We have a communication crisis. We've had climate action plans for 20 years. That's not the hard part. What we don't have is the community buy-in and the community support. And we have what we call the implementation gap. So it's through storytelling that we galvanize people to invigorate them to actually want to roll up their sleeves and go work in their communities to do the hard work. And how we do that ultimately is by telling stories about how we're going to achieve this.
Hello, I'm Denise Withers, and you are listening to Forward, an interview series where today's leaders reveal how they use stories to make change and shape the future. If you need a new way to move forward towards your goals, then stay tuned, because I have just the story for you. As many organizations, municipalities, and leaders are discovering, climate action plans are worthless if nobody implements them. Yet few have figured out how to get unstuck and engage their people in getting the job done. That's why the work Jeff Biggers does at the Climate Narrative Project is so important. He draws on decades of experience as a journalist, oral historian, and author to help communities shape new narratives on climate change and regenerative solutions. As a global leader in climate change communications, Jeff has worked with groups ranging from the elite of Silicon Valley to small towns devastated by broken economic and social systems. His narrative change work has been featured in the New York Times and Chicago Tribune, as well as on NPR and MSNBC. I know he has amazing insights to share and can't wait to get started. So welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
So you just actually sent me a note about some of the cool stuff you've been doing in Gary, Indiana, and I know you've been working all across the states using narrative and stories as a way to inspire action and help people really imagine a better future. So I wonder if you could kick us off by sharing an example of how you've been doing that in your work.
Sure. Gary, Indiana might be a good way to begin. About 5-6 years ago, I was invited to do an artist residency in Gary. And Gary is quite unusual for listeners who are not really sure where it's located. Gary is just along the south shore of Lake Michigan, within a stone's throw of Chicago. It's part of that whole industrial belt along the south shore. Gary is really one of the largest steel mill cities in the world, on the planet. Still today, over 9 miles of the south shore is taken up with a massive steel mill. Of course, it's not once like it used to be, but still it's a significant part of the industrialization of that area. And so here's Gary, a city struggling to maintain both an economy, but also a sense of resilience. It's a city that was gutted economically in the 1960s and 70s through white flight, when the first African-American mayor of one of the first largest cities in the United States was elected in 68. And then through all sorts of political machinations, and the city was just economically gutted, both its tax base and also its job base. And then just the community itself began to fall apart. So here we are, half a century later, dealing with the city, trying to understand what its role is going to be in not only a new economy, but in a world faced with issues of climate change, environmental crises, and really the fallout of industrialization. Some of the worst rates of asthma, some of the worst rates of pollution from lead-impacted pipes, some of the worst areas of pollution, both from the residual of the factories going into the waterways. You know, Gary has it all. So this community brought me in to do an artist residency, to essentially as a writer, to be there and to be part of the community. The one little other detail, Denise, I want to add about Gary is that South Shore butts up against one of the most spectacular places I've seen in my life. It's called the Indiana Dunes. It's actually a national park now. It has the fourth largest area of biodiversity in any national park in all of the United States, because these dunes, even though we're up in the Lake Michigan area, have served almost as an arena or a cauldron for so many different types of plants and species. And so here you have this incredible beauty next to this incredible beast of the steel mills and this city that's really been gutted in the middle. So as a writer, I began to do my research, to do oral histories, to collect stories, to understand how people were living today and historically what context they were coming from, a city that's largely African-American. And then we met as a group to try to understand, well, where do we want to go from here? How do we want to create a resilient city, a city that's going to be going into the next century? And what kind of economy are we looking at? And that's when we began to follow a type of storytelling process that I've used with many towns and cities and campuses, both across the United States and in Italy. It's to envision ourselves in the year 2030, that we've already arrived at becoming what we call a regenerative city, a city that's self-sustaining, a city that not only consumes resources, for example, the resources we need for our energy or for our food or for our water and waste, but a city that actually provides for them in a way that is circular in fashion, that actually regenerates its resources. The other part of becoming a regenerative city was the concept of healing the damage, both the environmental damage, but the socioeconomic damage that has happened from industrialization, and to begin the process of repairing and bringing back the community as a community itself. And so that's another major part of the storytelling, is how we come together to tell our stories, to envision where we want to be there, but more importantly, how we got there.
So what kind of response did you get to this work?
So it was very interesting. So this is 5-6 years ago. I worked with an urban farmer. I worked with an educator. I worked with a rapper. I worked with other artists. And once again, we went into the community and collected stories. I think a very important footnote for me, for people who want to work on storytelling and in communication issues, is the need to go out and do our homework and do our field research. I think so many times we think of storytellings as people sitting down and speaking off the cuff. And I think what I have found is our need to do the background research, to do the field research, to go through the archives, to actually physically be there, to kind of fill in the blanks of a lot of stories and provide a better, clearer cultural context. So we did a lot of that work too. We went into the archives, we met with historians, we met with reporters, we met with writers and other people who lived. And we began to come up with this idea of what would an eco-city, an ecopolis, look like in 2030? So the idea is not to create some utopian vision, but the idea is to take these stories and make them geographically rooted. You know, this is a Gary story. This is a story coming from the people from Gary who know exactly where they are now and where they want to be. And how do we create these dynamics? Okay, we're going to talk about transportation. We're going to talk about our energy use. We're going to talk about our food use. You know, the typical things we talk about when we set out a climate action plan. And where do we want to get there? How do we create this regenerative city, this resilient city? And once we kind of made that vision, then we told stories backwards. So not going forward in utopian view, the idea was to go backwards and show the audience how we did it, how we changed the infrastructure, for example, to go from being a city based on 90% of the people jumping into their cars to go out to the suburbs to go shopping, to creating infrastructure where we had more low carbon or zero carbon transit, more ways of getting around in the community. We talked about how we would rethink a circular economy to bring things inside, how we would rethink where we got our food. You know, over 90% of the food being imported, how do we flip that to where suddenly we're producing 90% of our food within a central area? And so each area, we had a story talking about how we got there. So the impact was quite interesting. We held this event about 5-6 years ago at a church. It's called the Progressive Church, that actually already had solar panels completely covering the electricity production. Outside was a beautiful urban farm and orchard, and already had begun the process of being completely regenerative, a completely self-sufficient entity. At the same time, it was right in the heart of Gary, in the heart of a neighborhood that for the most part was abandoned, in front of a historic high school that also was abandoned. And so the idea was, how do we envision taking these abandoned properties and turning them into ultimately what would be a recreation of a new neighborhood by 2030? And that also became part of the story. So it was quite interesting. So We wrote our story. We workshopped it. We worked with each other. We brought in a jazz band from Gary. We used multimedia images in the background to help connect our words with images. And then we put it on stage at this church. The production was co-sponsored not only by the kind of usual suspects, environmental groups like Sierra Club and whatnot, but also was co-sponsored by urban farming groups, by others, kind of social cultural groups that normally wouldn't be connected to this. And it's also included a lot of folks from the religious communities. And we purposely did hold it within a religious confound. And the experience was amazing, Denise. It was amazing for people to see something that once again was very uplifting, very powerful, very compelling to be in what a lot of people have written off as a city that has no future. You know, the requiems for Gary have been written for decades. And to say we're going to be able to regenerate, to revive, to really resurrect this incredible community and give it a vision, an incredible, sustainable vision for the future. And we're doing that with a soundtrack, the jazz transition from Gary. We're doing that with images in Gary itself. And we're doing it not with me as an outside writer performer, but I got out of the way and we let Gary artists and Gary actors tell the story themselves. So it's very, very powerful. And then just to finish this long story, afterwards, we had a lunch that was catered by local urban farms. And we had this incredible discussion about, okay, so now we just did this performance. We just did these stories. How do we begin to take the steps to actually arrive there? You know, so it's not something we just did it and walked away from, but we took this. And because there still was that incredible energy, we really began to plan it out.
There's so many things I love about that story. The focus on the idea of rebirth and what's the positive story that we can tell instead of what we typically hear, which are the stories of loss and sacrifice when we think about how we need to respond to climate. Goodness, I want to unpack so many pieces of that. So my most burning question right now is, why do we need to be telling stories to help us move forward facing the problems that we're facing today? Because when we look at most climate action plans, they're focused on technologies or buildings and emission standards and things like that. And we're not really talking about culture. We're not really talking about story. So why do we need that? And how does that fit into your drive to do this work?
Sure. You know, so I came to this work. I created what's called the Climate Narrative Project about 8 years ago. And I came to it out of a sense of failure. You know, I had been as a reporter and as a historian writing about energy and environmental issues for 20 years. And realizing ultimately that you felt like you didn't have a whole lot of impact. Specifically, I filed stories for years and wrote books for years, looking at the impact of coal mining, both on coal miners and coal communities and the environment and then ultimately on climate change. And feeling like ultimately we didn't move the needle very much in terms of getting people to really care or care enough to be galvanized enough to actually get out of their chair and go do something to stop coal mining and coal burning. And so it was that sense of failure of saying, not I give up, you know, I'm going to go live in Italy and put my head in the sand. The idea was, okay, roll up my sleeves and let's find a better way to tell this story. And that means I wanted to work with filmmakers. I wanted to go back to the theater. I wanted to work with dancers. I wanted to work with visual artists. I wanted to work with musicians. And of course, other ways of telling our stories. The idea was to bring in all the arts to tell a more effective story. Because, Denise, I really feel like we don't just have a climate crisis. We have a communication crisis. We've had climate action plans for 20 years. The same ones we're talking about now, I wrote stories about 20 years ago. So we know what the plan is. That's not the hard part. We already have incredible models. You have villages in India that are already 100% carbon free. If you go to Siena, Italy, you're not just going to see the beautiful, you know, piazzas, but you're going to realize that town is completely 100% carbon free. If you go to Copenhagen, likewise. So we have the examples. What we don't have is the community buy-in and the community support. And we have what we call the implementation gap. That even if you're a great city in Vancouver or Salt Springs Island or all these amazing places you have up in BC want to do things, if there's not the community buy-in to both support the politicians and the city officials, then there's going to be this implementation gap. It's just going to wither. It's just not going to happen. It's going to be a watered-down version to not really push it through. And I think that's what we've seen. So it's through storytelling that we, once again, I use the word galvanize a lot, which I guess goes with Gary being a steel city. We want to galvanize people to invigorate them to actually want to roll up their sleeves and go work in their communities to do the hard work. And how we do that ultimately is by telling stories about how we're going to achieve this, not just some blueprint or some plan or some action ideas, but the actual visual work that we're going to do.
And there's two key pieces in there that you've talked about. So one is this idea of making the abstract idea of whatever's in our climate action plan really tangible and specific to the place that we're talking about. And also, you mentioned this earlier, this idea of co-creation, where it's not your story, right? It's the story of the people. They're creating their own story of the future. They own it. They're the ones who are going to execute it. And so tell me a bit more about how you've been able to bring that into the work that you're doing.
Right. So that's a great question, because that's really one of my big criticisms, I think, of a lot of NGOs and environmental groups, is they kind of come up with these blueprints, which are hatched in urban confines of either DC or New York or Vancouver or wherever. And then they feel like they can just go and plug people into it, not realizing there's so many barriers, so many cultural forces against implementing that, not to mention just the politics. And I know this from firsthand experience. As you've probably seen from my background, I come from a coal mining community in Southern Illinois, that a lot of my initial interest was the fact that we had a nearly 200-year-old family farm get strip mined. And as I'm traveling around the world, looking at all these amazing places and writing stories about it, realizing my own family, my own culture, my own area has been devastated by our addiction and the power of the fossil fuel industries. And so to come in to my community and say, okay, here's your climate plan, just totally doesn't make sense, because it kind of misses the point of what's been going on for the past 200 years. So part of my work, and this is where I kind of diverge a lot, you know, I'm not trained actually as a journalist. I just kind of fell into journalism, and I'm actually not even trained as a historian. I'm trained as an oral historian. And my exemplar was Studs Terkel out of Chicago, where, you know, you just literally sat down and listened to people and asked questions like you're doing to have them tell us ultimately what the social context and cultural context of who they are and how they're living and what they're trying to do. And it's that element of oral history that I feel like is often missing in a lot of our climate work, that we simply need to go into communities and just listen for a long time to really understand on the ground level, the real grassroots level, but even below the roots of, you know, what has happened to this region, this soil. You can't talk about a climate plan unless you understand literally the soil and what has happened to, once again, the ethnic conflicts. You know, with Gary, you can't talk about Gary without talking about major environmental racism that still continues today. We just finished a play with Indiana University Northwest, and it was quite interesting because it talked about how you had a university in the middle of Gary. And really, there was this dynamic between trying to bridge the Black Lives Matter movement with the environmental movement around the context of climate chaos and the climate crisis. So this is kind of a blur of all these different issues, but it really comes down to first going into communities and listening before we then can begin to write our own stories, because those stories have to be rooted really in the local geography, the human geography, and the natural geography.
I agree 100%. And especially what we're seeing here more and more so in British Columbia is a recognition that a lot of those stories live with our Indigenous knowledge keepers, right? They live in our First Nations. They've been here much longer than we have. They understand the land. They understand the cycles. They understand what's been going on here. And so we're just now starting to see a bit of a shift here where we're recognizing that if we want to figure out how to go forward, we need to do it with them. Because they know so much more than we do. So that really resonates with me. And then on the flip side, I get so frustrated because ultimately this kind of work needs funding. It needs to come from somewhere. And selling, listening, and selling that kind of investment in deep listening and history and collecting that background can be really, really tough. So can you talk a bit about what it takes in terms of a climate or champions or the right time or the right setting to be able to get the support that you need to be able to go in and do this work?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if I really have a really poignant answer to it, other than just, as I often say, just rolling up our sleeves and keep knocking on the doors. A lot of my work now comes to me, communities here from another community, a campus here from another campus, programs like your own or other news media kind of get the word out that this is happening. And I find a lot of people, both campuses and university, colleges, schools, and towns are coming to me because they realize what they have tried fail. Hey, we did all this thing. We have a perfect climate plan and only 4 people showed up at the meeting. Or a campus, you know, we do all these different things and still the kids aren't interested. You know, what's going wrong? Once again, I feel like you and I are having a conversation that a lot of people have been having for many, many years, but in a very small group, constantly kind of banging their heads against the wall of like, why aren't people paying attention? Why aren't people buying into this? Why aren't we doing more? You know, why is my campus only doing recycling for the past 80 years? Why can't we have solar panels on our municipal buildings? Why do in Iowa, where you're talking to me now, why do we still import 92% of our food when we're supposedly the breadbasket of the nation? And so people come to me often out of a sense of like, what do we do? And that's where they realize all the time and money they invested in these very high-priced consultants to come up with these super slick brochures and climate plans. And it's almost laughable, Denise, and I try not to be cynical about it, but I've seen so many towns go through this process. You have a city manager who has been trained ultimately to do one thing, and that's to keep the tax revenues flowing and keep building the city. Growth, growth, growth. And now suddenly they have to come up with a climate plan. So their first thing is to not look locally, not look to their local movements or their grassroots movements or, God forbid, indigenous people or immigrants. They look at these high-priced consultants from outside who can come up and create the slick brochure and the slick plan and the slick PDF that they can ultimately file. And I think that's the problem that we're realizing is, you know, we've got to move beyond that and wait before we do this climate plan. And once again, go back and talk to the community first and find out, you know, ultimately what is the story of the community in order to bridge and bring this climate plan and make it a reality, ultimately to have that community buy-in and that real implementation. And I keep coming back to that because it's the same story. I've done storytelling projects in Silicon Valley and San Jose with the elite of the high-tech communities. And I've worked with tiny little communities in Appalachia where I've invested a lot of my life. I've worked with a lot of East Coast elite schools. And then I've worked a lot in the American Southwest. And it is always the same story. How do we get the community engaged to support this? And the only way to do that is to go back and listen to the community.
I'm so with you there. And the piece that I'm finding now is, yes, do that. And engage the community in creating the future story that they want. Because ultimately, if it's not what they want, they are not going to support it. So, you know, one of the projects we're working on, we're really focusing on what are the co-benefits of climate change? And how does that help you create the life that you want, rather than just trying to sell climate action as the right thing to do? So for me, it's all about moving the storytelling piece from the very end where you've created your climate action plan and then you say, oh, and by the way, we better tell the story of this work, moving that story design work all the way back to the very beginning to say, can you actually help us create the strategy? And strategy is really just a story about how we're going to do something, right? So how do we actually create that climate action plan as a story? And then as you've been doing, bring that to life. So I totally resonate with everything that you're saying.
And I don't think we have any choice. You know, I wrote a book a few years ago when Trump was elected called Resistance to Reclaiming an American Tradition. And the reason why I wrote the book was when Trump was elected and the first thing he did was to pull out of the Paris Climate Summit, my 12-year-old son came to me and said, hey, Dad, is there any hope? And, you know, you look at your children, you don't want to have this kind of glib, oh, everything's going to work out, don't you worry, because I know the realities of what we're facing with our climate crisis. And so instead of writing a book about hope, I went back to my own experience in the civil rights movements, with my parents, realizing that hope resists. It's really about creating a movement of resistance, what I call cities of resistance. And that is ultimately something that we've been grappling with for years, is you have to recognize the failures of the systems we're living in. We talk about adaptation, but if you're adapting to a failed system, that's not adaptation, that's failure. You know, you've got to break that up. And I think this is part of our storytelling, you know, and once again, take Gary, Indiana. You drive through it and you go, oh my gosh, look at this destroyed city. It's dangerous. Let's get out of here. And you don't really look at, well, why did a city get gutted? Why did a city get destroyed? And what has happened to the people here in terms of those who've been polluted and impacted both in the workplace safety? And that is part of being the city of resistance. So resistance has to be a big part of our climate story too. And sometimes that word invigorates people, but I think often it scares, oh no, we're going to scare off certain communities that we need to be with us. We need to have this kind of little bit more of a Pollyanna look at the future of, you know, this is what we could do. These are all the beautiful benefits of what we're going to be doing. But the truth is, this is also the reality of our situation that we need to resist against and fight against. We need to really start about changing our system if we're going to actually arrive at this beautiful vision of climate action. And that's the hard part. But let me tell you, once again, working in Silicon Valley, I was invited to work with the super elite schools and institutions whose children, they're the children of the leaders of Google and Facebook and Apple, of course. And then we'd worked in the community, and then we'd worked with city officials. And it was fascinating because they get it. The people who really are at the apex of so much of the development of capitalism really understand if we're going to have any future at all, we have to come to grips with the reality of the system that's failing right now.
And so when we look at that, my last question really is then, how do we scale this amazing work that you're doing? Because there's you and you're doing incredible stuff and you're doing it in so many places. And yet the only way we're going to get out of the mess we're in is to be able to scale that. So what are you doing in that way? What are your ideas about how we do that?
You know, everywhere I go, I tell campuses and towns and cities and schools, the most important thing you can do right now is hire a climate storyteller. Don't hire another consultant. And obviously, I got a bone to pick with all these high-priced consultants. Don't hire another public policy institute where my dear friends work at. We don't need to hire certain people right now. We need to invest our money in climate storytellers, local people. We need to cultivate them. The root of our culture really comes from colere, you know, Latin, talking about how we can cultivate storytellers. But, you know, the way you're going to cultivate them is by putting resources into them. And so my dream is really to train a new generation of climate storytellers, that young people go in, once again, through listening, through bringing people together, through doing their field research, and then envisioning what the future could be and telling that story. We create this movement of climate storytellers, and that's what we need. And I'm still not there. You don't know how many doors of foundations I've been knocking on, saying, hey, I love all the projects you fund, but can you put a little money into the arts, into climate storytellers, climate artists, people who are going to really help us tell this story in an effective way? And it's hard. It's very hard, let me tell you. So much of my work is I'm able to get funds from here. You know, I robbed Peter to pay Paul. And so much of my work, especially in poorer communities, is just because I really feel dedicated to them. The resources are still just not there. And I think that's somewhere we really need to be banging on the doors and saying, you really got to come up. The money is there. I mean, I'm sitting in a town with the University of Iowa, one of the great institutions of writing. And we just signed a contract to pay our football coach $56 million. And then we're told there's not enough money, not only just for sustainability issues, but to begin talking about climate projects and narratives. There's just no resources. And the money is there. It's how we want to put them. And that's where, once again, how do we get this very effective group of people to keep telling our stories, to get the community buy-in, to support, to agitate, educate, and ultimately make this kind of change?
It's ultimately, and ironically, how do we change the narrative on storytelling so that people start to recognize the ROI of it? Yeah. So if people want to follow up with you, they want to connect with you, they want to learn from you, have you got courses going on? Tell me a bit about how they can do that.
You know, they could connect through me through my website, jeffbiggers.com. And I work with different institutions. Right now, I'm working with a school in Connecticut and some other schools where I come in and I do residencies, either a couple of days or longer, where ultimately my plan is to go in, do a series of workshops. And then at the end of the week, by working with both students or if I work into a town or a city to work with the local community groups, that they have their own kind of climate narrative project and Acropolis that they can then run with. I just kind of show them what I know, put out the seats. We do some sort of event or performance, and then hopefully it evolves into their own project. And I'm very happy to do that in both on school and community level. And then my dream, once again, is to kind of create some sort of training for climate storytellers where I can one day find the resources to do a week here, a week there, where we bring people together and we train people with the idea of then we're going to send them back out. No different than a civilian conservation corps or any kind of groups is that we have to train people to do this kind of work and to go into the communities. I think people like Greta Thunberg, who actually came to Iowa and ended up climate striking with my son, by the way, went on to become a climate striker, is very effective, Greta, because of her way of speaking. When she talks about cathedral thinking after the burning down of Notre Dame, when she talks about ways in which we can change society, she's very clear and to the point. And I've really used Greta a lot on how we do frame these issues, that we don't look away. We don't try to sugarcoat anything, but we really have to tell the truth and really look people straight in the face and say, how do you get up in the morning and plan the rest of your day knowing what we're facing with the climate crisis today? If you live in a community, if you have children around you, and I think those are the kind of very clear, stark, compelling kind of narratives we really need to embrace today if we're going to have a true climate community and a climate plan. So thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories. And I'm definitely going to continue to follow your work, and I'll make sure my listeners can find you to learn more. So thanks again, Jeff.
You've been listening to Forward, a podcast about how leaders use stories to shape the future. If you'd like to know more about how story design can help you develop and sell your big idea, get in touch at denisewithers.com.